West Legal Aid Center would like to welcome you to the audio program, Whistleblowing in the Corporate World Series, Part 5, Corporate Lawyers as Whistleblowers. Thank you for joining our presenters, Nancy Moore, Professor, Boston University School of Law, and Jordan Thomas, a partner with Labaton Sucharo and a former Assistant Director in the Enforcement Division of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Thank you for joining us, and I will now turn things over to our speakers.
Good afternoon, and thank you for participating today in the fifth installment of our webinar series, Corporate Lawyers as Whistleblowers. In our first program, the advent of the SEC Whistleblower Program, we addressed the origin and basic mechanics of the SEC Whistleblower Program. In the second program, the Securities Law Primer, we provided an overview of the laws that govern the securities industry. Next, in the third program, Accountants as Whistleblowers, we discussed the important role that accountants can now play in protecting investors following the enactment of Dodd-Frank. Next, in the fourth in the series, we looked at the SEC enforcement process and discussed the rich heritage, unique culture, and the complex operations of the agency's national enforcement program from an insider's perspective. Now, we are pleased to have a great program for you in which Professor Moore and I will be discussing the unique issues that come about with corporate lawyers as whistleblowers. At one time, attorneys' duty to maintain corporate clients' confidences, even in the face of anticipated or ongoing corporate wrongdoing, was thought to be virtually absolute. But that changed over time as relevant rules and laws gave lawyers greater discretion to make public disclosures to avert corporate clients' misconduct. And now, following the enactment of the whistleblower provisions of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, attorneys will sometimes not only have the discretion, but a financial incentive to blow the whistle, as well as anti-retaliation protections when they do so. Professor Moore and I hope and expect that attorney whistleblowing will be limited to rare situations which there is a fundamental breakdown in corporate governance. With that, let's begin our presentation with on slide three, or four, corporate challenges. Next slide, which is slide five. These are some key survey findings that may be of interest to you. In 2009, KPMG conducted an integrity survey in which 74% of employees indicated they had personally observed or had firsthand knowledge of wrongdoing, get this, during the previous 12 months. 47% didn't believe that they would be protected from retaliation if they reported misconduct. 61% didn't believe they would be satisfied with the outcome if they had reported misconduct. And 60% in the banking finance industry reported that the wrongdoing they observed could lead to a significant loss of public trust if discovered. Arguably, some of these findings are the reasons in which the SEC whistleblower program was established by Congress. In November 2011, Little & Mendelson, a well-regarded firm that represents corporate America, conducted a whistleblower survey in which 96% reported concern about whistleblower claims. 73% reported this is an emerging risk area. 67% predicted that whistleblowing claims would increase, and 65% reported only being moderately prepared. One of the goals of this presentation is to make those who work in corporate America focus more on this area so that they can be fully prepared for potential internal reporting. The Ethics Resource Center in January 2012, in its National Business Ethics Survey, reported that 45% of those surveyed witnessed misconduct at work. 42% reported that their employer had a weak ethical culture, and 22% of employees who had reported misconduct perceived retaliation. The next slide. My law firm, Labaton Sucharo, in July of 2012, conducted a US-UK financial industry survey. 39% believed their competitors had engaged in illegal or unethical conduct. 26% had observed or had firsthand knowledge of misconduct in their workplace. 24% believed that you had to engage in illegal or unethical behavior to succeed. 16% would engage in illegal behavior, insider trading, if they could get away with it. and 94% would report wrongdoing, given the protections and incentives of the SEC whistleblower program. A later survey of all Americans in September of 2012 found that 54% had observed or had firsthand knowledge of misconduct in the workplace, 84% had a positive perception of whistleblowers that report illegal or unethical conduct, and 83% indicated that they would be willing to report wrongdoing, given the protections and incentives of the SEC whistleblower program. Some of the takeaways that you can have from these survey findings is that wrongdoing in the workplace is more widespread and more significant than commonly thought. The second takeaway, and an important one, is that there has been and continues today to be a breakdown in trust between employees and their employers. And this breakdown has affected people's willingness to report misconduct, whether it's internally or externally. The last takeaway that I'd like to bring to your attention is the idea of people's new willingness in light of the SEC whistleblower program to report misconduct. And it's that willingness that is important for responsible organizations to pay attention to and to focus, again, on strengthening their internal reporting systems so that misconduct is dealt with at the earliest possible level. Next slide. The SEC whistleblower program. Let me walk you through some of the key components, and then Professor Moore will take time to walk you through the implications for attorney whistleblowers. Next slide. We're now on slide 8. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act was enacted in July 2010. The act required the SEC to establish a whistleblower program which offered three primary things: the ability to report anonymously, it provided robust employment protections for those who wish to report, and significant monetary awards. The implementing rules for the program became effective in August 2011, but people were allowed to file written whistleblower submissions after Dodd-Frank that could be perfected once the implementing rules came into effect. Next slide. Let's talk about who can be a whistleblower. Any individual who alone or jointly with others provides information to the SEC relating to a possible violation of the securities laws that has occurred, is ongoing, or is about to occur can be a whistleblower. However, only individuals, not companies, are eligible for the whistleblower protections and incentives in Dodd-Frank. One of the things to note is in defining whistleblower, it defines it as someone who wishes to report a possible violation of the securities law that has occurred, is ongoing, or is about to occur. This is an important thing because it means that the scope of potential whistleblowers is quite broad. It's not just things that have occurred or ongoing, but things that may occur. Next slide. Let's talk about anonymous reporting. In many ways, the ability to report anonymously is the best anti-retaliation protection because the SEC whistleblower program allows people to report anonymously if they are represented by counsel. And if they are represented by counsel, even the SEC won't know who the person is who made the report unless or until the individual chooses to accept the monetary award. And after that, the SEC is required to keep the identity of the whistleblower confidential and non-public, except in certain very limited circumstances. There is one warning here, though. If you are considering reporting anonymously, you cannot or should not contact the SEC before seeking representation by counsel, because if the SEC knows your identity and then you subsequently file with the help of an attorney, the SEC can't pretend that they didn't know who you were. Next slide. Let's talk about the employment protections. Employers are prohibited from discharging, demoting, suspending, threatening, harassing, directly or indirectly, or in any other manner discriminating against a whistleblower because they engaged in a protected act. Now, the next slide talks about what protected conduct, types of protected conduct. One is providing information about possible securities violations to the SEC. Another is participating in an SEC investigation or related enforcement action. And the last type of protected conduct is making disclosures to the SEC required by law. Next slide. Regulatory requirements for the employment protections. The requirements are relatively straightforward. A whistleblower must have a reasonable belief that a possible securities violation has occurred, is ongoing, or is about to occur. And they must comply with the SEC rules. The SEC rules require that a whistleblower file a form with the SEC making its complaint or tip. The form is relatively straightforward, and it's a critical component. Sometimes people confuse the fact that the SEC has incentivized people to report internally first with their them receiving protections. So if someone is concerned about potential retaliation, they should consider filing either simultaneously or filing first with the SEC so that they have the benefits of the protections provided for in Dodd-Frank. Next slide. An individual who has been retaliated against can bring a private right of action in federal district court. There's no administrative exhaustion requirement as it has been in the past. There's an unwaivable right to a federal jury trial. And if successful, they may receive reinstatement with equivalent seniority, 2 times back pay with interest, and attorney's fees and related expenses can be reimbursed. Next slide. The statute of limitations, or the period in which someone can bring a retaliation action, is 6 years after the date the retaliation occurred, or 3 years after discovering retaliation, but in no event longer than 10 years after the date of violation. Next slide. Let's talk about monetary awards. Subject to the eligibility requirements, the Commission will pay an award or awards 10 to 30% of the monetary sanctions collected to one or more whistleblowers who voluntarily provide the SEC with original information that leads to the successful enforcement by the Commission in a federal court or an administrative action in which the SEC obtains monetary sanctions totaling more than $1 million. To give you a sense, about 20% of SEC enforcement actions have monetary sanctions in excess of $1 million. And every year, the SEC secures monetary sanctions of more than $2.8 billion, with some cases having monetary sanctions in excess of $100 million. The SEC will also pay an award based upon amounts collected in certain related actions. The most common types of related actions are those brought by the Department of Justice. A good example might be the Siemens case, where the government, both the Department of Justice and the SEC, secured $800 million in monetary sanctions split amongst the two agencies. Next slide. So voluntarily provide is one of the elements of this. What that means is that there's no pre-existing legal duty or agreement to provide such information to the SEC. Information provided to the SEC before receiving a request, inquiry, or demand relating to the same subject matter from the SEC or other federal, state, or self-regulatory organizations are the kinds of requests type of information that would be within the voluntarily provided category. Next is original information. Information is original if it is not already known to the SEC, not exclusively derived from allegations in a judicial or administrative proceeding, and it's important to note that word exclusively. So you can take information that was derived from a judicial administrative proceeding as long as it's not exclusively what you provided to the SEC. And the information must be provided to the SEC after July 21st, 2010, the date in which Dodd-Frank was enacted. Now, this is important. Information can be derived from a whistleblower's independent knowledge. This is often insider knowledge, something that people learned firsthand within their organization, or independent analysis. The latter factor is something that we saw in the Madoff case, where Mr. Markopoulos reported on misconduct by Mr. Madoff based upon publicly available information. So you don't have to be an insider to be an SEC whistleblower. Next slide. leads to successful enforcement action. The SEC will consider the information that you provided to have led to successful enforcement action if the information was sufficiently specific, credible, and timely to cause the staff to commence an investigation, an examination, or to reopen an investigation. The information can also be given if it significantly contributes to the success of an ongoing examination or investigation. So the SEC or DOJ or some other organization may make public that it's doing an investigation relating to a particular company. If a whistleblower knew significant information that would be significant to that investigation, they could come forward and also be an SEC whistleblower. Next slide, monetary sanctions. Monetary sanctions are wide and broadly defined as all monies, including penalties, disgorgement, and any interest ordered to be paid and money deposited into a disgorgement fund or other fund pursuant to Section 308B of Sarbanes-Oxley. To meet the $1 million minimum threshold, monetary sanctions from actions that arise out of the same nucleus of operative facts may be grouped together. Next slide. Let's focus on the criteria for determining the amount of award. Factors that may increase an award include significance of the information provided, the degree of assistance provided by the whistleblower, law enforcement interest in making the award, and participation in internal compliance systems. The last factor was provided by the SEC to encourage people to report internally when it's safe, first. Factors that may decrease an award include culpability or involvement in the reported misconduct, unreasonable reporting delay, and interference with the internal compliance systems. The last two factors under the decrease in award section also relate to internal compliance and reporting systems. So in these, the SEC is clearly trying to send the message of the importance of these systems and seeking to ensure that they are not undermined by the new program. Next slide. As with any program, there are some individuals who are ineligible to participate in the monetary awards of the program. Now, it's important to note that the requirements for filing anonymously is having someone being represented by counsel. That's it. The employment protections requires that you file the required form and that you, in good faith, have made the allegation. That's it. So all of these other sort of criteria and eligibility factors are all related to monetary awards. Now, whistleblowers that are ineligible for a monetary award but could be eligible for reporting anonymously or employment protections are individuals criminally convicted for related misconduct, members, officers, and employers of the SEC and other enumerated organizations, family members and those that reside with an SEC member or employee, members, officers, and employees of a foreign government, individuals that knowingly or willfully provide false information to the SEC. Next slide. There are certain individuals that have qualified eligibility for an award. Attorneys, which we'll talk about here in a moment, accountants, officers, directors, trustees, and partners, employees or contractors whose duties involve compliance or internal audits, individuals retained to conduct an internal investigation involving possible violations, individuals who obtained information about violations from an ineligible individual. All of these individuals could be eligible to report. However, it depends whether they've satisfied the necessary prerequisites. The first three bullets have been covered in the Thomson Reuters series that you're listening to now, and there are also articles that I've been fortunate to co-write with different professors on these subjects, and I encourage you to look at those, one of which is in your materials today. Next slide. Attorney's eligibility for a monetary award. The general rule is the implementing rules for the SEC whistleblower program prohibit attorneys from using information obtained through a communication protected by the attorney-client privilege or through the representation of a client to qualify for a monetary award. The exception to this, however, is that the rules permit an attorney to receive an award if the attorney-client privilege has been waived or disclosure of the otherwise confidential information is permitted by the applicable attorney conduct rules or the SEC Rule 205.3. At this point, I'm going to hand it over to Professor Moore, who can walk us through what the attorney conduct rules are, SEC Rule 205.3, and generally federal preemption.
Thank you, Jordan. As Jordan has said and indicated through these materials, that the attorney's eligibility for a monetary award is limited by the nature, restrictions on the nature of the information that the attorney uses in order to blow the whistle. These restrictions are designed to offer protection, continuing protection, for the confidentiality obligation that lawyers have to their clients. So I want to talk a little bit about the duty, the lawyer's duty of confidentiality to a client, and the ways in which the different sources of that obligation, prima facie protection of the confidentiality of certain information, and exceptions that are recognized in various bodies of law. If you turn to slide 26, before we talk specifically about a lawyer's duty of confidentiality, the first thing that you as a lawyer would need to establish is, are you in a lawyer-client relationship with the organization? To the extent that you are employed by or retained by the organization specifically for the purpose of providing legal services, and this could be either as an outside lawyer, sole practitioner, or through a law firm, or as an employee in the in-house counsel department. Under the American Bar Association's Model Rule 1.13A, and this is relatively uncontroversial, I don't think there are any jurisdictions, regardless of whether they adopt this language or not, it's pretty uncontroversial that to the extent that you're employed by or retained by the organization to provide legal advice or services, your client is the organization itself, not the individuals who retained you, although it is recognized that organizations can only act through their duly authorized constituents, that is, officers, directors, or employees. Special issues arise for lawyers who are in-house, who are actually employed by the organization. Lawyers often serve in both legal and non-legal capacities. Non-legal capacities could include service as a member of a board of directors, service as an officer of the company, or service in various employee capacities. Commonly, for example, lawyers serve as a compliance officer. Lawyers may perceive themselves as being in a non-legal capacity and may think, therefore, that, well, these lawyer confidentiality rules don't pertain to me. This has come up not infrequently, sometimes in connection with lawyers who want to serve as quitam relators in a False Claims Act proceeding. Very often a lawyer will say, well, I was a compliance officer. I wasn't a lawyer representing a client. Nevertheless, courts will look to the specific facts and circumstances to determine whether the lawyer was in fact performing legal services, giving legal advice, even when ostensibly in a non-legal capacity. To the extent that you're, even when you're serving as in-house counsel within the general counsel's department, that doesn't necessarily mean that everything you do, every communication that you engage in or other information that you obtained, is obtained in your legal capacity. Courts are aware that lawyers serving as in-house lawyers commonly wear multiple hats. Sometimes they're involved in business decisions and services, sometimes in a purely legal role. It's often helpful to the extent that you're a lawyer serving in either legal or non-legal capacity that at various points in time you clarify with the individuals with whom you're dealing whether or not you're serving in a legal or non-legal role. The default test that courts will often apply for an attorney-client relationship, that is, in the absence of an express agreement as to whether at any particular point in time you're serving as a lawyer or a non-labor lawyer, courts will often ask the question, did the corporation, did the organization reasonably believe that you as a lawyer were performing legal services on behalf of the corporation? And under those circumstances, courts will find that you were acting as a lawyer, sometimes even when you were actually, you know, when your title is a non-lawyer title. Moving on to slide 27, a lawyer's, once we've established that you are a lawyer representing a client, there are two sources for a legal duty of confidentiality. One is the attorney-client evidentiary privilege, and the other is a professional rule of confidentiality. The attorney-client evidentiary privilege is protected under both state and federal law. With respect to state law, it can be contained in common law judicial decisions or sometimes through codification. Under federal law, it's exclusively a common law privilege. Federal Rule of Evidence 501 simply acknowledges that the evidentiary rules for purposes of federal court proceedings have not been codified, but rather exist only through common law decisions. With respect to professional rules of confidentiality, these are almost exclusively referenced in state rules of professional conduct, typically rules that are adopted by the state's highest court, sometimes, as in California, with sort of a co-presenter role with the legislature, but most typically they are court rules. The rule, the ABA model rule that protects confidentiality, at least for current clients, is Rule 1.6. That rule number is the same in almost all jurisdictions. California is the only state that has not adopted the ABA numbering system. All other states have adopted some version of the ABA model rules. The numbering system differs in a couple of states. Texas and Maine, I believe, have somewhat unique numbering systems. The moving on to slide 28, I want to talk first of all about procedural differences, how you determine whether it's the privilege or the rule of confidentiality that applies, and then I'll go on and talk about the substantive differences. With respect to both procedure and substance, you can think about the differences in terms of the attorney-client evidentiary privilege being extremely narrow, and the rule of confidentiality extremely broad. One of my colleagues, Professor Stephen Gillers from NYU Law School, has asked us to imagine a series of concentric circles. So within the broader circle, there's a smaller circle. The smaller circle represents the evidentiary privilege. The larger circle represents the professional rule of confidentiality. And this image of concentric circles works both with respect to procedure and with respect to substance. With respect to procedure, keep in mind that the attorney-client privilege is a rule of evidence. As such, it applies only in the context of judicial proceedings. So it is the right of a client to prevent testimony, certain types of testimony, and certain types of document production on the basis that that testimony or that document production is protected by the evidentiary privilege. The rule of confidentiality is extremely broad. It is not limited to any form of judicial proceeding. It applies to a lawyer's use of or disclosure of client information in any context, whether that be voluntary or compelled, not being limited to judicial proceedings. With respect to substantive differences, we can talk first about the type of information that's prima facie protected, and then with respect to the prima facie protection, what exceptions are recognized by either common law or rules of professional conduct. the attorney-client privilege prima facie protects only narrowly certain types of information. The information has to have been in the form of a communication between a client or client representative and a lawyer or a lawyer's representative, such as a paralegal or a secretary or administrative assistant. It has to have been a confidential communication for the purpose of securing legal advice or services. When we're talking about the protection of a corporation's privilege, the communications are limited to information communicated by and to only certain types of constituents within the organization, within the corporation. With respect to states, states differ in terms of a very narrow control group test in which only those constituents who essentially speak for and control the organization, only their communications are protected. That's typically a very limited group that belong to senior management. A number of states have a much broader scope of employment test in which looking at virtually all employees in an organization, as long as the employee is communicating information related to the scope of his or her employment for the purpose of seeking legal advice or services or acting on such advice or services, the attorney-client privilege would apply. In federal courts, the key case is the Upjohn case. I'll give you the citation, which is not included in the slide. It's Upjohn versus United States. The citation is 449 U.S. Reporter 383, 1981. It didn't, the Supreme Court in that case, for purposes of federal court proceedings, did not specifically adopt the scope of employment test, but the case-by-case test it adopted is very similar to the broader scope of employment test adopted by many state courts. The rule of confidentiality, on the other hand, the prima facie protection, is as broad as it could possibly be. Under Model Rule 1.6A, which is adopted by most, you know, the vast majority of jurisdictions, all information relating to the representation, regardless of its source, is prima facie protected. The lawyer has an obligation not to use or disclose such information. In the context of a corporate client, there is no limitation whatsoever on the source of information. It includes any individuals, either inside or outside the corporation, for example, including former employees or other non-client witnesses. With respect to former clients, so for attorneys who have left either voluntarily or otherwise, the duty of confidentiality remains. It's specifically acknowledged under Model Rule 1.9C. It is virtually the same duty that's owed to current clients, the exception being for information which is generally known. And generally known information, by the way, is not the same as publicly recorded. So the mere fact that information is obtained in a public record does not mean that it's generally known. So the fact that something happens to appear in an SEC filing, if it's relatively obscure and is not something that's widely known by the public, then that information would continue to be protected. Moving on in slide 30, what about what exceptions are recognized under both the attorney-client privilege and the professional rule of confidentiality? Beginning with the attorney-client privilege, there are recognized exceptions for joint clients, that is, if there's a dispute between formerly commonly represented clients. There is no privilege vis-a-vis the joint clients themselves. The privilege remains with respect to third parties, such as the government, for example. There is a crime fraud exception, which is similar to but not necessarily the same as an exception that I'll talk about in a minute with respect to exceptions that are under the rules of professional conduct. There is an exception that allows lawyers to disclose information when they are sued by their client for a breach of duty or when the client is suing the lawyer for legal fees. There's an exception for claimants through a deceased client and client waiver, which includes failure to object. In slide 31, I want to talk a little bit about the substantive differences with respect to exceptions under the rule of confidentiality. Here it is critical to understand that although I'm going to be talking about the model, the ABA model rules, in fact these rules vary considerably from state to state, and you must be aware of your own state's exception. That will be critical in determining whether or not you are eligible for a monetary award, whether or not the information you disclosed, whether or not that was protected either through your state rules or through the SEC rules 205.3. You may disclose under the ABA model rules if you have the informed consent of your client, if you're impliedly authorized to carry out the representation, for the prevention of death or serious bodily harm. And here I have bolded the exceptions which I think are most pertinent to the Dodd-Frank whistleblower program, and that is you are authorized to disclose in many jurisdictions to prevent substantial economic harm through client crimes or frauds in which the lawyer's services were used, or to rectify substantial economic harm through client crimes or frauds in which the lawyer's services were used, in controversies between the lawyer and the client, which applies in terms of the retaliation protections, to secure advice concerning the lawyer's compliance with the rules, and when required by law or court order. Keep in mind that there are a number of jurisdictions that allow disclosure to prevent but not to rectify substantial economic harm. That's an important difference between jurisdictions. There are some jurisdictions that permit disclosure regardless of whether the lawyer's services were used. That is, if you're a lawyer who simply happens to find out information relating to the company, even though you weren't involved. So again, you really need to check your own state rules before you think about disclosing under Dodd-Frank. On slide 32, it's important to be aware of special rules that apply to corporate lawyers, both under Model Rule 1.13, which has been adopted again with some significant variations in the states, and in the SEC Rule 205.3. Both of these rules require up-the-ladder reporting within the organization. When you either know that the client is committing crimes or frauds involving the corporation in a violation of law, or under this SEC rule, which is more broadly covers any credible evidence of fraud or other material securities violation. Aside from these reporting up the ladder requirements, both Model Rule 1.13 and SEC Rule 205.3 permit reporting out, which means reporting beyond the organization to the SEC or otherwise, under certain circumstances. The SEC rule provides that lawyers may disclose information to the SEC if the lawyer reasonably believes disclosure is necessary in three circumstances: to prevent a material violation likely to cause substantial financial injury to the issuer or to investors, to prevent the issuer, that is a publicly held company, from committing or suborning perjury or perpetrating a fraud on the commission, or to rectify the consequences of a material violation in furtherance of which an attorney's services were used. Model Rule 1.13C is narrower. It permits disclosure beyond that already permitted by Rule 1.6, but only to prevent harm to the corporation, not to prevent harm to shareholders or other investors, and only if the reporting up is unsuccessful, which is not an explicit requirement under the SEC rule. What's the relationship between the SEC rules and the state rules of professional conduct? On slide 33, we talk about federal preemption. Under the law of federal preemption, a law or regulation enacted by the federal government preempts conflicting state law. With respect to the disclosure provisions of Dodd-Frank, including its explicit incorporation of SEC Rule 205.3, Dodd-Frank preempts any state rule of professional conduct that has narrower disclosure provisions than are provided for in the SEC rule. And I point specifically to at least two states where that would apply. Both California and Rhode Island have very, very narrow disclosure provisions. They have no provision to disclose to prevent merely financial harm as opposed to physical injury. As a result, even if the financial harm is a result of a client crime or fraud. Those state rules would not apply to lawyers in California and Rhode Island if disclosure is more broadly permitted under SEC Rule 205.3. Now, in addition to disclosure rules, you need to think about rules regulating conflicts of interest. And this is most particularly true in terms of lawyers who are currently acting within organizations, particularly those lawyers who are formally representing the organization. Under Rule 1.7 of the ABA model rules, and this is a rule that does not have much state variation, almost all state rules are either identical to or very, very similar to the ABA model rule. Without disclosure and consent by the client, a lawyer may not represent or continue to represent a client if that representation will be directly adverse to a corporate client, or, and this is the one that's most significant, where there's a significant risk that representing the corporation will be materially limited either by a lawyer's responsibility to another client or by some personal interest of a lawyer. And, of course, personal interest of the lawyer includes a lawyer whistleblower's interest in receiving a monetary award. So if you have anonymously filed as a whistleblower with the SEC, and then you continue to represent a corporation with respect to the subject matter on which you've disclosed information relating to the SEC, you may very well have a conflict of interest under Rule 1.7, which under the ethics rules would require you either to withdraw from that representation or to continue representing the client only with the client's informed consent.
Professor Moore, this is Jordan Thomas. I just wanted to add a wrinkle to this that requires consideration by the participants on this program, is that there are three pillars to the SEC whistleblower program. There's the ability to report anonymously, there's the employment protections, and the monetary awards. The question will have to be considered by an attorney whistleblower is first, do you wish to receive a monetary award? Some of my clients that have been attorneys actually expressly did not want to receive a monetary award because they did not want to be perceived as kind of benefiting from the kind of the company on the back of the company. So they may be able to continue the representation because there's no kind of upside to their having filed. Only the protection against misconduct by the company if they retaliate against them. So that's just something for it's an important decision point for a potential attorney whistleblowers, and once that decision is made, it then flows into the conflict analysis.
Jordan, let me ask you a question just to follow up on that, because I would have thought that even though the whistleblower, the attorney whistleblower, says, all right, I'm going to report anonymously, but I have no intention of seeking a monetary award, there's nothing that I'm aware of that would bind the lawyer to that decision, so that subsequently, for example, if it turns out that the SEC has used that information and obtained an enormous financial award to the SEC, if there's nothing that prevents the lawyer at that time from changing her mind and submitting a form as to be considered eligible for the award, to the extent that that's true, I think that has an impact on the attorney's ability to continue representing the client without getting the disclosure and consent. And as I say, that's just something that I think both the whistleblowing lawyer and I think both Jordan and I will strongly suggest that attorneys or anyone else, but particularly attorneys who are thinking about whistleblowing, would be very well advised to consult an attorney.
There's a lot of questions
that come up that, you know, you may not have thought about.
I wholeheartedly agree, both in how significant some of these decisions are and the benefit of seeking independent counsel. I think that in the scenario you described, is it possible that an attorney could change their mind and choose to accept the monetary award? I think the answer is yes, from the SEC whistleblower perspective. Program perspective. And if they were to make that determination, I think that they would be more vulnerable to a action by the state licensing authorities or bar association relating to the representation. Because I guess it's possible that they could have a defense of good faith and somehow be able to prove it, but I think it would be much more difficult to make that sort of case that there wasn't as the slide shows, significant risk. And so that's something that would have to be would be a significant decision, and there'd be some risk. But the key, our goal today is to basically tee up the questions, and so that if an attorney whistleblower were in this circumstance, they would be able to think through these issues with counsel if desired.
And that actually reminds me, Jordan, you mentioned specifically the possible consequence of a disciplinary proceeding by the state disciplinary authorities for violation of the ethics rules. Keep in mind that there are other remedies that do not necessarily flow from a violation of the rules of professional conduct. But there are common law actions by a client against a lawyer for either malpractice or breach of fiduciary duty. Courts typically look to rules of professional conduct at least for guidance. In many of these cases, you will have, for example, an ethics expert testify as to whether or not the lawyer violated applicable rules of professional conduct as an indicator of whether or not the lawyer breached his or her standard of care. How those malpractice, these are typically state actions, state malpractice or breach of fiduciary duty lawsuits, how they relate to the Dodd-Frank provisions, again, is something that we can't really answer that question now, other than to say that although Dodd-Frank, unlike the disclosure rules, what's important here is to keep in mind that the Dodd-Frank provisions very specifically reference state rules of disclosure and do not attempt to preempt, except for the somewhat broader provisions of SEC Rule 205.3. Other than that, the rules specifically say you must continue to follow the state disclosure rules. There is no similar express reference to state conflict of interest rules like Rule 1.7 or as on, I indicate on slide 35, Model Rule 1.4, which talks about the obligation to keep a client reasonably informed with respect to the representation. And again, keep in mind a lawyer who is, let's say, involved in a representation in which the lawyer sees possible violations of the federal securities laws, anonymously reports. But then to the extent that the client is unaware that the SEC has been told about these possible violations, is there a conflict then? Is the lawyer obligated to comply with Rule 1.4? What's the interaction? To what extent has the Dodd-Frank provision for anonymous reporting, to what extent does that preempt the requirement of a client to communicate important information relating to the representation? Now, one possible response is rather than to say, well, look, to the extent that Dodd-Frank provides for anonymous reporting, that simply means that the ethical rules are no longer in force, that you've got a complete preemption. That's not necessarily, even if there's some preemption, that doesn't necessarily mean that perhaps the lawyer need not disclose that he or she has reported anonymously, but the lawyer might then be required to withdraw from the representation in order to avoid a violation of the ethics rules. That's not too terribly difficult if you're an outside attorney to withdraw from the representations due to an undisclosed conflict of interest. That happens not infrequently. It's much more difficult for a lawyer who's employed within an organization in which you either quit your job, which most lawyers, I think, are not necessarily prepared to do, or you request a reassignment. And within an organization, I think, as a practical matter, it's going to be very difficult and uncomfortable to say to your corporate superiors, I can't tell you why I want a reassignment, but I really don't want to work on this particular matter anymore. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, Jordan.
Just kind of as a broad thing, I think the best practice for interpretation of laws like this is to try to narrowly tailor the federal preemption. And so I think that an attorney whistleblower who took the position that basically Dodd-Frank preempted all state attorney professional rules would be taking great risk. I think that the conflict is kind of strongest when you're dealing with the confidentiality rules that exist within the professional rules. But the conflict rules, I think, is something where there is a reasonable expectation that those two may be able to coexist. And so I do think that an attorney who chose to seek a monetary award would have to work very hard or show a good track record of disengagement from the aspect of representation. By the way, this is not the broad representation of you are representing the company. If you're representing the company on tax matters and the misconduct involves an unrelated securities matter, you're unlikely to have a conflict. But if it's relating to the same subject matter in which the reporting to the SEC occurred, then I think it's more difficult, and the burden is likely to shift to the attorney whistleblower to disengage from that. I don't believe that one. I think that the conflict again is stronger with the under the 1.4, the reasonably informed concept, because I think it's very difficult to be able to report anonymously yet have to reasonably inform. So I don't think those two can exist well together. So I think there's a greater probability of preemption under those circumstances. But the conflict is a unique challenge and one that counsel would be wise to talk to independent counsel about how to navigate that within an organization. All right. Anything else, Professor Moore, that you wanted to share on that point?
No. I think I've pretty much finished my specific slides, and perhaps we could move on to some of the common questions.
Well, sure, we can do that, but let's open this up just to be sure. Are there any questions that the audience has that we can answer? Because we only have a few more minutes, and we want to be sure that we're able to touch on the questions of the audience. Well, if any pop up, please let me know, Professor Moore. I will quickly move through the remaining slides. On slide 37, it says what constitutes a security, and there's two slides here that talk about both the definition of a security and the Howey test, which allows you to determine what an investment contract is. What I want you to take away from this is that what constitutes a security is beyond stocks and bonds. It's actually quite broad. To give you a quick example, if there were toxic dumping behind a factory, most people's first instinct would be that it's an environmental violation, not a securities violation. But if you added only a few more facts, it very well could be. If the company was a public company, if the toxic dumping was significant, if the remediation, if it had been done in the financial statements of the relevant periods, would have been material to the financials, it's very possible that it could have been a securities violation. So for non-traditional sort of securities violations, think more to how significant the misconduct is than what it looks like on first impression. Next slide I'd like to direct your attention to is 40. What is the international reach of the securities laws? Next slide, 41. With few exceptions or qualifications, a whistleblower can be any individual or group of individuals regardless of citizenship. Eligible securities violations can occur anywhere in the world. Potential international violators can be individuals or organizations. Things that you want to look for to establish jurisdiction would be investors, investments, operations, employees, or clients in the United States. And remember that the SEC whistleblower permits law enforcement authorities in the U.S. to share information with foreign regulators. We'll skip slides 42 and 43. Let's go to slide 45, which are the most common types of securities law violations. In order of the types of violations that the SEC whistleblower program has received, market manipulation, offering fraud, financial fraud, are the top three, with about 16-17% of the submissions coming from these areas, in each of these areas. And then you have insider trading and pricing type violations, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and municipal securities fraud, rounding out the top seven. The next several slides are descriptions of these types of violations, but I'll leave those for you to look at if you have an interest. Slide 53 talks about the statute of limitations for SEC enforcement actions, which is, as a rule of thumb, is 5 years. However, there are ways to toll the statute. The discovery rule and fraudulent concealment or equitable tolling doctrines would allow this for cases to be brought even after that by the SEC. But as a rule of thumb, if it's in less than 5 years, it's well within that. There are slide 56 and 57 talk about tips for every responsible organization. The first is, and we could talk a great length in these areas, but it's worth just quickly going over these, is one, invest in compliance. I know during these difficult economic times, people look to cut compliance programs, but that is exactly the type of mistake that leads to much bigger problems later. Have a game plan, because especially for bigger organizations, anticipating that there will be reports of misconduct and figuring out how you want to handle those internally and externally will save you time and ensure that appropriate resolution is handled. Self-report if it's significant. The SEC whistleblower program, SEC has a new cooperation program that many organizations and individuals can benefit from if they report themselves. Number four, communicate more. This is particularly important because too many organizations are not sharing with whistleblowers information about the complaint that was raised, and people regularly assume that organizations are not doing the right thing when they don't hear, which undermines the culture of integrity within an organization. and results in unnecessary external reporting. And last, establish a culture of integrity. Too many organizations are focused on the latest policies and procedures rather than establishing a culture of integrity that will deter misconduct or ensure that it stops sooner. So let's move on to slide 59, which is what things that every potential lawyer whistleblower should know. First, consider addressing the problem internally first. In many cases, this is both a legal requirement, whether it's this, under the state hierarchy or the federal guidance. It is also something that will allow for an attorney whistleblower to receive a higher potential monetary award because it's something that the SEC has seen as important to protecting investors. Number two, consult with independent counsel. The decisions of coming forward and how to come forward internally or externally can be difficult, and sophisticated attorney whistleblowers will consider consulting independent counsel to ensure that they don't make any unnecessary mistakes. Third, know the odds. It is not always glamorous, easy, or lucrative to be a whistleblower, and so it's important that whistleblowers put together thoughtful submissions and that they're doing it for the right reasons, which hopefully is to protect investors. Fourth, attempt to identify violations. The SEC looks to investigate possible securities violations and looks for cases that have corroboration. To the extent that you can build a submission based upon the potential violations, that will increase the probability the SEC will investigate and be successful. You don't have to be a securities lawyer, but it does help if you can highlight what you believe to be the misconduct. Legally collect evidence. The more corroboration, the more likely it is that the SEC will investigate. However, again, it's important to consult with counsel or do research regarding tape recording of conversations or removing documents from the workplace, among other things. Six, remember to comply with state attorney conduct rules that are not in conflict with Dodd-Frank. We spent a lot of time, and Professor Moore spent a lot of time talking with us about the conflict of interest rules. That is one that I think is particularly worthy of your focus as you consider coming forward. And seventh, report anonymously. Reporting anonymously may provide you with the greatest protections against retaliation, blacklisting, or any other sort of social stigma, and is something that may be worth considering. Professor Moore, did you have any other questions or comments?
Not really. I think this is a very good list. In terms of legally collecting evidence, keep in mind that, you know, this applies to questions as to whether or not you have stolen documents. When you take, for example, your employer-owned laptop and bring it in and ask an attorney to simply copy the hard drive and take all the documents off of them and peruse through them, you know, in a sort of fishing expedition to see what's there. It applies to taking communications that are themselves protected by the attorney-client evidentiary privilege and turning them over to counsel or to the SEC. It's extremely important to be aware of all of the different legal restrictions on the evidence that you attempt to use in the whistleblowing process.
That's definitely true. If you'd like more information about the SEC whistleblower program or about attorney whistleblowing, I would encourage you to visit secwhistlebloweradvocate.com. This innovative website uses videos, searchable databases, eligibility calculators, comprehensive legal primers, and collected thought leadership and timely blog entries to help responsible organizations to establish a culture of integrity and courageous whistleblowers to report possible securities violations. This concludes the formal presentation. Please feel free to reach out to us directly if you wish, and we encourage you to plug into the next webinar, which is Corporate Whistleblowing and the Corporate Insider. And if you missed any of the prior programs, you can get them on either SECWhistlebloweradvocate.com or through Westlaw, the West Legal Ed Center. We thank you for participating, and again, we welcome any questions. I don't see any questions. Professor Moore, do you see any questions?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, thank you for participating again, and we will welcome your comments or questions down the road. Thank you.
Thank you for selecting West Legal Ed Center. For optimal savings, why not consider a customized subscription? You'll get unlimited access to the largest, most current CLE library offered online. Call 1-866-765-MCLE for more information on how to maximize this opportunity. That's 1-866-765-MCLE for continuing education that's always comprehensive, always relevant, always current.